18 songs. Luo and I lay sprawled on his bed in our coats and shoes. We were dead tired. We had spent most of the night tramping across the mountain, and after crossing the bamboo forest, the sounds of invisible wild animals had accompanied us from afar until dawn. Suddenly, the smile faded from Four Eyes' face, making way for a scowl.
"Bloody hell! All you've got here is a load of smutty rhymes!" he barked.
His voice had the sharp edge of an army commander. I was taken aback by his outburst, but said nothing. All we wanted was for him to lend us a couple of books in return for our exertions.
"You said you wanted authentic mountain songs," Luo reminded him tensely.
"Ye gods! So I did! And I also told you I wanted uplifting lyrics with an undertone of romantic realism!"
As he spoke, Four Eyes held up one of the pages between finger and thumb and waved it in our faces. The crackle of paper blended with his scolding, schoolmasterly tone.
"What is it with you two? Always going for stuff that's forbidden!"
"Don't exaggerate," Luo said.
"You think I'm exaggerating? You want me to show this to the commune authorities? Your old Miller would be accused of spreading erotic material. He might even go to prison. I'm serious!"
Suddenly, I hated him. But I didn't show it. It was better to wait until he had kept his promise to lend us more books.
"Go on then, tell tales on the old man," Luo said. "I thought he was great. His songs, his voice, his weird rippling stomach, and the things he told us. I'm going back there so I can give him some money for his kindness."
Sitting on the edge of the bed, Four Eyes swung his skinny legs up on the table and resumed reading our notes.
"How could you waste all that precious time writing down this drivel? I can't believe it! Do you seriously think an official journal would even consider publishing this shit? That they give me a job on the strength of this? You must be out of your minds!"
The change he had undergone since receiving his mother's letter was truly remarkable. A few days before, it would have been unthinkable for him to snap at us like this. I hadn't suspected that a tiny glimmer of hope for the future could transform someone so utterly. He was insanely arrogant, and his voice seethed with longing and hatred. There was not the slightest mention of the books he was supposed to lend us. He jumped up, scattering our notes on the bed, and went into the kitchen. We could hear him chopping vegetables while he grumbled away.
"I suggest you collect all your papers and put them away in your pockets, or better still, burn them in the stove right away. I don't want any of that forbidden stuff lying around, least of all on my bed."
Luo joined him in the kitchen.
"Give us a couple of books and we'll go."
"What books?"
I heard Four Eyes whine while he went on chopping the cabbages and turnips.
"The books you promised us."
"You think I'm crazy or what? All you've brought me is useless garbage, which will only get me into trouble. And you've got the cheek to pretend that they're..."
His voice stopped, and he stormed into the room again, still holding his chopping knife. He grabbed the papers from the bed and ran to the window to read them over once more by the light of the early sun.
"Good God! I'm saved!" he cried. "All I need to do is make a few alterations. I can add the right words here and there, and I can cut out the offending ones. Dimwits, that's what you are. At least I can think straight, which is more than I can say for the pair of you."
Without more ado, he proceeded to read out his adapted, or rather skewed, version of the first song.
"Tell me, little bourgeois lice, what do they fear? They fear the boiling wave of the proletariat."
I leaped to my feet and lunged at him. In my indignation, all I wanted was to snatch the papers from his grasp. But as I flailed my arms, I involuntarily punched him on the jaw, which sent him reeling. The back of his head crashed against the wall, the knife fell from his hand, and his nose started to bleed. I tried to get hold of our notes so that I could tear them up into little bits and stuff them into his mouth. But he held on to them tight. I hadn't been in a fight of any kind for such a long time that I got quite carried away, and for several minutes I lost track of what was happening. I noted that his mouth was wide open, but didn't hear what he was shouting. I came to my senses again outside. Luo and I were sitting by the wayside at the foot of a boulder. Luo stabbed his finger at my Mao-style jacket, which was stained with Four Eyes' blood.
"You look like a hero in a war movie," he told me. "Well, no more Balzac for the time being."
Whenever anyone asks me what the town of Yongjing was like, I quote what my friend Luo had to say on the subject. So small that when the local canteen prepared a dish of beef and onions, the smell reached the nose of every single inhabitant. In fact, the town wasn't much more than a single high street about 200 meters long with a post office, town hall, general store, library, and school. There was also a restaurant attached to the hotel, which had a dozen rooms. At the far end of the town, halfway up a hill, was the district hospital. That summer, the headman of our village sent us to town several times to watch films. I was convinced that the real reason behind his liberal attitude was the irresistible attraction of our alarm clock, with its proud peacock-feathered rooster. Our ex-opium grower-turned-communist was besotted with it. The only way he could have it all to himself, even for a short time, was to dispatch us to Yongjing. During the 4 days it took us to get there, see the film, and return to our village, he would be lord and master of the clock. Towards the end of August, that is to say 1 month after our argument with Four Eyes and the ensuing breakdown in diplomatic relations, we set off for Yongjing again, but this time we were accompanied by the little seamstress. The basketball court turned open-air cinema was crammed with spectators. They were still showing the old North Korean film, The Little Flower Seller, which had moved the four sorceresses in the little seamstress's house to tears. It was a bad film, and seeing it a second time was not likely to change our opinion. But that didn't dampen our spirits. For one thing, we were glad to be in town again, even a town no bigger than a pocket handkerchief. Memories of city life came flooding back, and, believe me, even the smell of beef and onions savored of sophistication. What is more, Yongjing had electricity instead of the oil lamps we were used to. I wouldn't go so far as to say that our visits to town had become an obsession, but at least having to trudge across the mountain to see a film meant getting 4 days off from laboring in the fields, from carrying human and animal dung on our backs, or from toiling in the paddy fields with water buffalo whose long tails whacked you across the face. The other reason for our high spirits was that the little seamstress was with us. By the time we arrived, the film had already started, and there was only standing room left behind the screen, where everything was in reverse, and everyone was left-handed. But the little seamstress didn't want to miss this rare treat. As for us, we were content to watch her lovely face bathed in the luminous colors bouncing off the screen. Now and then, everything would go dark, and her eyes would shine like spots of phosphorus in the gloom. Then suddenly, when the scene changed, her face would light up, flush with color and blossom with wonder. Of all the girls in the audience, and there were at least 2,000, she was certainly the prettiest. A sense of masculine pride stirred deep inside us, surrounded as we were by the jealous looks of the other men in the crowd. About halfway into the film, she turned to me and whispered in my ear. Her words pierced my heart. "It's so much better when it's you telling the story." The hotel we went to afterwards was very cheap. 5 pence for a room, barely the price of a portion of beef and onions. In the courtyard, we came upon the old bald-headed night watchman, whom we already knew, dozing on a chair. He pointed up at one of the windows where a light was shining and told us in a low voice that the room had been taken for the night by a woman traveling on her own. She was aged about 40, he said, and had come from the provincial capital. She would be leaving for Phoenix Mountain in the morning. "It's her son she has come for," he added. "She has found him a good job in the city."
"Her son's being re-educated?" Luo asked.
"Yes, just like you." Who could this fortunate person be? The first of the 100-odd city youths on our mountain to be released from re-education. The question kept us awake at least half the night, feverish with envy. Our beds felt as if they were on fire. It was impossible to sleep in them. We had no idea who the lucky boy might be, although we went over and over the names of everyone we thought might be a candidate, excluding those of us who belonged in the 3 in 1,000 category, because we were sons of bourgeois parents like Four Eyes, or sons of class enemies like Luo and me. We were on our way home the next day when I happened to meet the woman who had come to rescue her son. Just before the footpath rose steeply among the rocks to lose itself in the white clouds shrouding the peaks, we caught sight of a vast slope dotted with Tibetan and Chinese tombs. The little seamstress wanted to show us where her maternal grandfather was buried. Not being partial to cemeteries myself, I stayed behind while she and Luo explored the forest of tombstones, some of which were half submerged in the ground, others covered in thick creeper. I settled down under an overhanging rock, and as usual, lit a fire with dry leaves and some branches. I took a couple of sweet potatoes out of my bag and was burying them among the embers when I looked up to see the woman sitting in a wooden chair lashed to the shoulders of a young man. What was really surprising was that, in her none-too-steady seat, she displayed an almost superhuman serenity and was knitting, as though she were sitting on her balcony at home. A slight figure, she wore a dark green cord jacket, tan trousers, and a pair of flat-soled shoes made of soft greenish leather. When they drew abreast with me, her porter decided to have a rest and lowered the chair onto a flat-topped rock. The woman simply went on knitting, making no move to get down from her chair. She didn't even glance at what I was doing, nor did she exchange a single word with her porter. Using the local accent, I asked her if she had spent the night at the hotel in Yongjing. She nodded her head in confirmation and resumed her knitting. She was an elegant and undoubtedly rich woman who wasn't going to be taken aback by anything. I took a stick and speared a sweet potato from among the smoking embers, tapping it against a stone a few times to shake off the ash. I decided to switch to another accent. May I offer you a taste of mountain roast?
You speak with a Chengdu accent, she exclaimed. Her voice was gentle and melodic.
I explained that Chengdu was where my relatives lived, that it was my hometown. At this, she got out of her chair, and still holding her knitting, came over to sit by my fire. She was clearly not used to squatting down in such informal circumstances. She accepted my offer of the sweet potato with a smile and blew on it, but avoided taking a bite by asking what had brought me to this remote place. Was I being re-educated? Yes, on Phoenix Mountain, I replied, poking my stick into the ashes to find another sweet potato.
Really? She cried. That's where my son is being re-educated. You may have met him. It seems he's the only one up there who wears glasses.
The point of my stick glanced off the sweet potato, stabbing the ashes. My head swam as if I had been struck in the face. Is your son Four Eyes?
Yes, he is.
So he's the first of us to be released?
Oh, have you heard? Yes, indeed. He is going to work for a literary journal.
Your son's an incredible expert on folk songs.
I know. At first we were afraid he'd be wasting his time on the mountain, but we were mistaken. He has assembled a collection of splendid peasant songs, which he has adapted and modified. The editor-in-chief has shown great interest in the words.
It's thanks to you that he was able to do his research. You gave him plenty of books to read.
Of course.
She lapsed into silence, then glared at me with suspicion.
Books? Certainly not, she said coldly. Thank you very much for the potato.
She was truly perturbed. Seeing her discreetly replace her sweet potato among the embers, rise to her feet and make ready to continue her journey, I regretted having raised the subject of books. Suddenly, she spun around and asked me the question I had been dreading.
What's your name? I'd like to be able to tell my son whom I met on the way.
My name? I echoed warily.
My name's Luo.
Hardly had this lie escaped me when I was filled with remorse. I can still hear the emotion in that gentle melodic voice as Four Eyes' mother cried out,
So you must be the son of the great dentist. What a surprise. Is it true what they say about your father treating Chairman Mao's teeth?
Who told you that?
My son told me in one of his letters.
I didn't know.
Didn't your father tell you? How very modest of him. He is reputed to be a very great dentist, very great.
Actually, he's in detention at the moment. He's been classed as an enemy of the people.
So I've heard.
Four Eyes' father has been having similar problems. Her voice sank to a whisper.
but I shouldn't let it worry you too much. Right now, ignorance is in fashion, but one day the need for good doctors will be recognized once more. Besides, Chairman Mao is bound to need your father's services again.
The next time I see my father, I will certainly pass on your sympathy to him.
You shouldn't lose hope either. As for me, although I seem to be busy knitting this blue jumper, what I'm really doing is composing poems in my head while my hands are occupied.
How fascinating, I said.
What sort of poems are they, may I ask?
That is confidential, dear boy. With the point of one of her knitting needles, she speared a sweet potato, which she skinned and then popped, piping hot, into her mouth.
My son likes you very much, did you know? He has mentioned you many times in his letters.
Really?
Yes. But he's not so fond of your friend, it seems, the young man living in the same village as you.
Quite a revelation. I congratulated myself on having assumed Luo's identity. Why doesn't he like him? I asked, trying to sound casual.
I think he's a bit sly. He suspects my son of having a suitcase hidden away, and every time he comes to visit, he is constantly looking for it.
A suitcase full of books?
I wouldn't know, she said, suspicious again. One day my son got so angry with the fellow that he punched him on the jaw and gave him a beating. I'm told he bled profusely.
I spluttered with indignation and had to quell the urge to tell her that her son's vivid imagination was better suited to fiction than to faking folk songs.
I didn't know my son was so strong, she went on. In my next letter, I warned him to stay out of trouble and never to get involved in such a dangerous situation again.
My friend will be very disappointed to hear that your son is leaving us for good.
Why? Did he want to get his own back?
No, I don't think so, but he'll have to give up hope of ever laying hands on the secret suitcase.
Well, that's too bad, I'm sure.
As her porter was beginning to show impatience, she bade me goodbye. Wishing me luck, she settled herself in her chair, took up her knitting, and was gone. The tomb belonging to the little seamstress's ancestor was some distance from the main footpath. It stood on a south-facing corner of the slope among the graves of the poor. Some were little more than mounds of earth of varying sizes. Others were in slightly better condition, their headstones sinking into the tall, wilting grass. The ancestor's grave was very modest, insignificant even. It was marked with a dark gray stone veined with blue, eroded by decades of harsh weather, and inscribed with just one name and two dates encapsulating an unremarkable life. Luo and the little seamstress laid down bunches of wildflowers they had picked nearby, redbud blooms with heart-shaped enameled leaves, cyclamens on elegantly curved stems, balsam flowers known locally as phoenix fairies, and also some rare wild orchids with immaculate milk-white petals set around a heart of the softest yellow.
"Why the long face?" the little seamstress called out to me.
"I'm grieving for Balzac," I shouted back. I went down the slope to join them and told them about my encounter with Four Eyes' mother, the knitting poetess. They didn't seem to share my indignation at the scandalous theft of the old miller's songs, nor were they unduly affected by the news that Four Eyes would be leaving the mountain, nor indeed by the prospect of losing Balzac. But they were greatly amused when I told them I had pretended to be Luo, the dentist's son, and their laughter filled the silence of the graveyard. Once again, I watched the little seamstress's face with fascination. She was breathtaking, as she had been the night before at the open-air cinema. But now that she was laughing, I was so utterly captivated that I wanted to marry her there and then, regardless of her being Luo's girlfriend. In her peals of laughter, I caught the musky fragrance of wild orchids, stronger than the scent of the flowers lying at her feet. Luo and I remained standing while she knelt down by her grandfather's grave. She prostrated herself several times, speaking soothing words to him in a kind of murmured monologue. Suddenly she swung her head round to face us.
"About those books of his, what if we stole them?"
It was thanks to the little seamstress that we were able to keep track, almost by the hour, of everything that went on in Four Eyes' village during the week preceding his departure, which was planned for September 4th. All the local gossip reached her ears. She had merely to listen to the patter of her customers, among whom there were men and women, headmen, and children from all the villages in the area. Nothing escaped her. Four Eyes and his mother, the poetess, were planning a grand celebration to mark the end of his stint of re-education. Rumor had it that the poetess had bribed the village headman into giving his approval for a farewell banquet to be held in the open air. The event, which would be attended by all the villagers, called for the slaughter of a buffalo. There was some confusion about which buffalo would be killed and in what manner, because it was against the law to slaughter working animals that were used in the fields. Although we were the only two friends Four Eyes ever made on the mountain, we were not on the guest list. Not that we minded. Indeed, the banquet would provide an excellent opportunity for us to carry out our plan to steal the secret suitcase. The little seamstress had a chest that had been part of her mother's dowry, and in the bottom of one of the drawers, Luol found a few large rusty nails. Like a pair of expert burglars, we set about fashioning a master key out of one of the old nails. We were so elated. I rubbed the nail against a rock until it became too hot to handle, after which I wiped it on my mud-encrusted trousers and polished it vigorously until the metal shone like new. When I held it up for inspection, it sparkled so brightly, I thought I could see my eyes and the late summer sky reflected in it. Luo took charge of the most delicate stage. Holding the nail down on the stone with one hand, he raised the hammer with the other and swung it. The hammerhead described a handsome curve in the air as it came down on the piece of metal, rebounding on impact in readiness for the next swing, and the next, until at last the required flatness had been obtained. One or two days before the break-in, I dreamed that Luo had entrusted the master key to me. There was a lot of mist, and I approached Four Eyes' house stealthily, almost on tiptoe. Luo was on the lookout under a tree. We could hear the villagers shouting and singing revolutionary songs as they feasted nearby. The entrance to Four Eyes' house had a double door. Each side was hinged in two holes, one in the threshold, the other in the lintel, and they were secured in the middle with a chain and a copper padlock. The lock was cold and beaded with moisture, and resisted my attempts to pick it for a long time. I turned the master key this way and that, and twisted it round with such force that I was afraid it would snap off in the keyhole. Finally, I grabbed hold of the left door and tried with all my might to wrench it free from the lower pivot hole. I didn't succeed. As a last resort, I tried the master key again, and suddenly, with a dry click, the padlock gave way. I pushed open the double doors, but hardly had I stepped inside when I froze in horror. There, perched on a chair behind a table, was Four Eyes' mother, calmly knitting. She smiled without speaking. I felt myself blushing and my ears turning red hot like a teenager on his first romantic assignation. She didn't seem in the least alarmed. I stammered something about a message for her son to find out where he was. She went on smiling, but didn't reply. The knitting needles flew in her long, bony fingers, and I noticed she had liver spots on the backs of her hands. I was mesmerized by the clicking needles twisting and turning at breakneck speed, in, round, through, off, to knit row upon row of stitches. I retraced my steps, slept outside, shut the two halves of the door quietly behind me, and replaced the padlock. Although there was not a sound from the house, I turned and fled as if my life depended on it. It was at that point that I woke up with a start. For all his assertions that first-time burglars had luck on their side, Luo was just as anxious as I was. He thought about my dream for a long while and ended up making some slight adjustments to the plan. Towards noon on September 3rd, the day before Four Eyes and his mother were to leave, we heard the frantic bellowing of a buffalo in agony rising up from the bottom of a ravine. The sound reverberated against the cliff and the echo reached the little seamstress's house. A few minutes later, a bunch of children came running with the news that the headman of Four Eyes' village had deliberately pushed a buffalo over a precipice. The slaughter was disguised as an accident. The perpetrator claimed that the beast had lost its footing on a tight bend and had plunged headfirst down the cliff. Its fall had been broken by a huge jutting rock, from which the mangled body slid only to land with a dull thud on another rock a dozen meters further down. The buffalo was still alive. I will never forget how affected I was by its long, drawn-out, plaintive bellows. Under normal circumstances, the bellow of a buffalo is disagreeably harsh, but on this calm late summer's day, the sound echoing through the Rocky Mountains was imposing and sonorous, like the roaring of a lion in a cage. A few hours later, Luo and I went to the scene of the accident. The buffalo's lowing had subsided. We elbowed our way through the crowd gathered at the edge of the ravine. Apparently, word had come from the commune leader that the animal could be put out of its misery. Relieved at having received sanction from on high, the headman, accompanied by Four Eyes and half a dozen villagers, had clambered down to the bottom of the cliff to cut the animal's throat. By the time we arrived, the deed had been done. Down in the bottom of the ravine, where the execution had taken place, we spotted Four Eyes crouching by the inert mass of the dead buffalo. He was collecting the blood pouring from the gash in a big upturned hat woven of bamboo leaves. The six villagers launched into song and started climbing back up the steep cliff, carrying the carcass between them. Four Eyes and his headman stayed down below. They sat side by side, hunched over the bamboo leaf hat filled with buffalo blood. "What are they doing down there?" I asked the man standing next to me.
"They're waiting for the blood to congeal," he replied. "It's a remedy against cowardice. To gain courage, you must swallow it when it's still lukewarm and frothy."
Luo, who was curious by nature, suggested going down part of the way to get a closer look. Four Eyes glanced up at the crowd from time to time, but it was impossible to say whether he had noticed our presence among the onlookers. At long last, the headman took out his knife, which had a surprisingly long, pointed blade. He caressed the edge with the tips of his fingers and then sliced the pudding of thick blood in two, half for Four Eyes, half for himself. The poetess was nowhere to be seen. What would she have thought if she had been there with us to watch her son bury his face in his cupped hands and slurp the clotted buffalo blood like a swine rooting in the mire? When he had finished, he sucked his fingers one by one to make sure not a drop was wasted. As he made his way up the steep incline, I noted he was still smacking his lips to prolong the taste.
"Just as well the little seamstress didn't come with us," Luo said.
Night fell. Columns of smoke rose from Four Eyes' village. In a clearing, a huge cauldron was on the boil. The receptacle was truly enormous and must have been a village heirloom. From our vantage point, the scene made a pastoral, good-natured impression. We were too far away to see the chunks of buffalo meat bubbling in the big cauldron, but the powerful smell, spicy and a trifle coarse, made our mouths water. The villagers were gathered around the fire with the women and children in front. Some people had brought potatoes, which they dropped into the cauldron. Others had come with logs and branches to feed the flames. Little by little, further ingredients were added to the stew. Eggs, maize cobs, dried fruit. Four Eyes' mother was the undisputed star of the evening. She was a fine-looking woman, in her own way. She wore a flower pinned to her breast. Perhaps it was a gillyflower. Her glowing complexion, heightened by the green of her cord jacket, made a singular contrast with the dark, tanned faces of the mountain folk. She showed her knitting to the women, and her handiwork, although unfinished, elicited cries of admiration all round. The appetizing aroma wafting towards us in the evening air became more and more penetrating. The slaughtered buffalo must have been extremely old, because its stringy flesh took longer to cook than that of a superannuated eagle. To us prospective thieves, the delay was harrowing, but Four Eyes, a fresh convert to blood drinking, was no less frustrated. We saw him jumping up and down with excitement, raising the lid of the cauldron, dipping his chopsticks into the stew, taking out a lump of steaming meat, sniffing it, inspecting it closely, and dropping it back with a disappointed shrug. We were huddled together in the shadows behind a rock. Luo murmured in my ear, pointing his finger, "Look, here come the guests of honor." The new arrivals were five old, withered crones. They wore long black robes which flapped in the autumn wind. In spite of the distance between them and us, I could make out their faces, which were as alike as sisters. Their features seemed carved in wood, and I recognized among them the four sorceresses who had come to the vigil at the little seamstress's house. They had apparently been invited to the farewell banquet at the instigation of the poetess. There was a brief discussion which ended when she took some banknotes out of her purse and gave one to each, under the covetous eyes of the villagers. This time there was not just the one sorceress with a bow and arrow. All five of them were so armed. Who knows? Maybe a bigger array of weapons was required to secure the safe passage of one privileged individual than to protect the soul of a man stricken with malaria. On the other hand, the little seamstress may have been unable to afford as much as the poetess, whose name was once celebrated throughout this province with its population of 100 million. While they were all waiting for the buffalo meat to have stewed long enough to be tender, one of the old women took Four Eyes' left hand and read his palm in the light of the blazing fire. We were just out of earshot and couldn't catch what the sorceress was saying, but we had a good view of her lowered eyelids, thin, pinched lips, and toothless gums as she muttered away. Four Eyes and his mother listened spellbound. When she stopped talking, everyone stared at her. An uneasy silence ensued, until all the villagers started talking at once.
I expect she made some gloomy prediction, Luo said. Such as his precious suitcase is about to be stolen? No, I bet it was something about demons getting in his way.
And he was probably right, because the next thing we saw was all five sorceresses rising up, swinging their bows belligerently into the air, and crossing them with their arrows while they uttered piercing cries. Then they performed a dance of exorcism around the fire. They started off at a slow pace, no doubt because of their great age, wheeling round and round on the spot, eyes fixed on the ground. From time to time they raised their heads and glanced anxiously around before bowing them again and intoning, like Buddhist monks, unintelligible incantations that were taken up by the crowd. Suddenly, two of the sorceresses threw down their arms and started shaking all over, presumably to signal the presence of demons. It certainly looked as if their bodies had been invaded by spirits, for the spasms made horrible monsters of them. The remaining three sorceresses arched their bows and pretended to let fly at their shaking sisters, making exaggerated imitations of the sound of arrows whizzing through the air. They resembled three ravens. As they danced, their long black robes billowed in the smoke, then dropped to the ground, raising little clouds of dust. The movements of the two dancing demons grew heavy, as if the invisible arrows had been tipped with poison, and after a while they slowed to a halt. Luo and I left just before their undoubtedly spectacular collapse onto the ground. The banquet was about to begin. We heard the chanting reach its climax as we flitted across the village. Since there was not a single villager, young or old, who hadn't jumped at the chance of some tasty buffalo meat stewed with cloves and chopped peppers, the place was deserted, exactly as foreseen by my friend Luo, who had revealed a gift for strategy as well as for narrative. Suddenly my dream came back to me. "Shall I keep a lookout?" I asked him. "No," he said. "We're not in your dream." Luo took the rusty nail, now transformed into a master key, and moistened it between his lips. The key slid noiselessly into place, turned to the left, then the right, left again, and a fraction the other way. There was a dry, metallic click, and the copper padlock yielded at last. We slipped into Four Eyes' house and immediately shut the double doors behind us. The place was so dark we could barely distinguish each other's faces, but there was a sense of imminent departure in the air, which made us ache with envy. I peered out through the slit between the doors. There was not a soul to be seen. To be on the safe side, that is, to make sure no busybody happening to pass by would notice the padlock was missing, we pushed the doors far enough out to enable Luo, as planned, to slip one hand through, replace the chain, and fasten the padlock. When Luo switched on his torch, we momentarily forgot all our carefully laid plans and stared in awe. For right there, on top of the stack of luggage, was the soft leather suitcase, glowing in the dark as though clamoring to reveal its contents. "There it is!" I cried. When planning our strategy a few days earlier, we had come to the conclusion that the success of our illegal entry hinged on one thing, knowing where Four Eyes had hidden his suitcase. How would we find it? Luo had pondered every conceivable solution, and in the end, thank God, he had come up with a plan. It had to be carried out during the farewell banquet. It was a unique opportunity. The poetess was no fool, of course, but she had reached the age at which being well organized becomes all important. Little could be worse on the morning of her departure than a last-minute rush to get the suitcase from wherever it was hidden. Everything would have to be ready in advance, and in impeccable order. We crept up to the suitcase. It was tied with a thick rope of plaited straw, knotted crosswise. We remove the rope and raise the lid in silence. Inside, piles of books shone in the light of our torch. A company of great Western writers welcomed us with open arms. On top was our old friend Balzac, with 5 or 6 novels. Then came Victor Hugo, Stendhal, Dumas, Flaubert, Baudelaire, Romain Rolland, Rousseau, Tolstoy, Gogol, Dostoevsky, and some English writers too, Dickens, Kipling, Emily Bronte. We were beside ourselves. My head reeled as if I'd had too much to drink. I took the novels out of the suitcase one by one, opened them, studied the portraits of the authors, and passed them on to Luol. Brushing them with the tips of my fingers made me feel as if my pale hands were in touch with human lives. It reminds me of a scene in a film, said Luol. You know, when a stolen suitcase turns out to be stuffed with money. So, are you weeping tears of joy? I said. No. All I feel is loathing. Me too. Loathing for everyone who kept these books from us. Hearing myself utter this last sentence frightened me, as if there might be an eavesdropper hidden somewhere in the room. Such a remark, casually dropped, could cost several years in prison. Let's go, Luo said, shutting the suitcase. Wait! What's the matter?
I'm not sure. Let's have another think. Four Eyes is bound to suspect us when he finds his suitcase gone. If he denounces us, we'll be finished. Our parents aren't like the others, remember?
I told you before, his mother would never allow it, or the whole world would find out that her son's been harboring forbidden books, and that would ruin his chances of leaving the Phoenix of the Sky.
After a few moments' silence, I reopened the suitcase. What if we just take a few? He won't notice.
But I want to read all of them, Luo said resolutely. He shut the suitcase again, and resting one hand on the lid like a Christian taking a solemn oath, he declared, With these books, I shall transform the little seamstress. She'll never be a simple mountain girl again. We moved stealthily towards the adjoining room. I went first with a torch, and Luo followed behind, carrying the suitcase. It seemed to be very heavy, for as we made our way, I could hear it bang against Luo's legs and bump into Four Eyes' bed and his mother's makeshift bunk made of wooden planks, which, although small, made the space seem even more cramped. We were startled to find the window, through which we had planned to make our getaway, secured with a nail. In our excitement at seeing the suitcase, we had forgotten to check it when we arrived. We tried pushing, but all we heard was a faint creak, almost a sigh. It wouldn't budge. The situation didn't strike us as disastrous. We returned quietly to the main room, intending to carry out the same maneuver as before, widening the slit in the double door just enough to allow a hand to slip through and turn the master key in the copper padlock. Suddenly, Luo whispered, Shush! Terrified, I immediately switched the torch off. Soft padding of feet outside held us transfixed. It took us a precious minute to realize that the footsteps were indeed coming in our direction. At that moment, we heard the muffled voices of a man and a woman, but couldn't make out whether or not they belonged to Four Eyes and his mother. Preparing for the worst, we crept towards the kitchen. In passing the pile of luggage, I switched the torch on for a second, while Luo replaced the suitcase. It was exactly as we feared. Four Eyes and his mother were upon us, and would catch us red-handed. They were talking by the door.
I'm sure it's the buffalo blood that has upset me, the son said. I keep having these evil-smelling burps.
Just as well I brought some medicine for indigestion,
retorted his mother. Panic-stricken, we were at a loss for somewhere to hide in the kitchen. It was pitch dark. I collided with Luo just as he was raising the lid of a container for storing rice. He was at his wit's end.
Too small, he whispered.
The chain rattled, and we just had time to bolt into the side room and crawl under the beds before the door flew open. They stepped into the house and lit the oil lamp. Things were not looking good. Instead of hiding under Four Eyes' bed, which would have made sense as I was taller and heftier than Luo, I was stuck under his mother's bed in a very tight space which, judging by the unmistakable odor, I was sharing with a soil bucket. Flies swarmed around my head. Making as little noise as possible, I tried to lie down flat, but bumped against the nauseating bucket, almost spilling the contents. I heard a little splash, which only made the horrible stench worse.
I jerked my head in a reflex action, thereby inadvertently making a sound loud enough to be noticed, and so give us away.
Did you hear something, Ma?
We heard Four Eyes ask.
No.
A complete hush descended, which seemed to last forever. I pictured the two of them frozen in dramatic poses, while they strained their ears to catch the slightest noise.
All I can hear is your stomach rumbling,
the poetess declared.
It's the buffalo blood. I feel really bad. I don't know if I can make it back to the feast.
I'm not having any of that. We must go back,
the mother insisted in an authoritarian voice.
There, I found the tablets. You better take two. That'll take care of your stomach ache.
I could hear Four Eyes heading dutifully to the kitchen, no doubt to get some water. The light of the oil lamp receded with him. Although I couldn't see Luo in the dark, I knew he was just as relieved as I was that we hadn't hidden in the kitchen. After swallowing his tablets, Four Eyes returned to the main room. His mother asked him if he was sure he had tied the rope around the suitcase with the books.
Of course I am. I did it earlier on.
But look, can't you see the rope lying on the floor?
How stupid of us to have opened the suitcase. A shiver ran down my spine as I crouched under the bed. I cursed myself for taking such a risk. In the gloom, I tried in vain to catch the eye of my accomplice. Four Eyes spoke calmly, but his voice betrayed his unease. I dug up the suitcase behind the house as soon as it was dark. When I came inside, I wiped off all the soil and filth and checked carefully to see whether the damp had got to the books. Before leaving home to join the feast, I tied it up with this straw rope.
So what happened? Can someone have gotten into the house while we were out?
Holding the lamp in his hand, Four Eyes crossed towards the side room. Under the other bed, I could see Luo's eyes flash in the approaching light. Thank goodness Four Eyes halted in the doorway. Turning round, he declared to his mother,
It's impossible. The window's still nailed fast, and the door was padlocked when we got here.
Still, I think you'd better look in the suitcase to make sure there aren't any books missing. Those two friends of yours worry me. I told you in my letters I don't know how many times not to get involved with such types. They're too sly for you, but you wouldn't listen.
I heard the lid being raised and Four Eyes replying to his mother's complaint.
I stayed friends with them because I thought you and Pa had problems with your teeth, that one day Luo's father might be of assistance.
Really?
Yes, Ma.
You are a darling, my son.
The mother's voice waxed sentimental.
Even in such difficult circumstances, you still think of your parents' welfare.
Ma, I've checked. There's not a single book missing.
Just as well. It must have been a false alarm. Come on, let's go.
Wait. Pass me the buffalo tail, will you? I want to put it in the suitcase. A few minutes later, while he was making a knot in the rope, I heard Four Eyes exclaim,
Shit!
Mind your language now, my son.
I've got the runs,
Four Eyes wailed.
Use the bucket in the bedroom.
To our immense relief, we heard Four Eyes running out of the house.
Where are you off to?
The mother cried.
To the maize field.
Have you got some paper?
No,
replied the son from afar.
I'll get you some,
the mother called. What luck that this would-be poet preferred to relieve his bowels in the open air. I can just see the horrific, stomach-churning scene that would have been inflicted on us had he chosen to pull the bucket out from under the bed and expel the buffalo blood in a horrible stream, or rather torrent, under our very noses. No sooner had the mother run out of the house than I heard Luo murmuring in the dark, Quick, let's get out of here. Luo swept the suitcase off the pile of luggage as he made for the door. It was only after an hour's headlong flight along a mountain path that we finally dared stop. Luo opened the suitcase. On top of the neatly stacked books lay the buffalo tail, black with a tufted end and stained with dark blood. It was exceptionally long, and no doubt once belonged to the unfortunate buffalo responsible for breaking Four Eyes' glasses. Part 3. It was all such a long time ago. But one particular image from our stint of re-education is still etched in my memory with extraordinary precision. A red-beaked raven keeping watch as Luo crawled along a narrow track with a yawning chasm on either side.
On his back, he carried the inconspicuous, work-soiled bamboo hod in which he had secreted Old Go, as Balzac's Père Goriot was titled in Chinese, the book he was going to read to the little seamstress, the lovely mountain girl in need of culture. During the whole month of September following our successful burglary, we were seduced, overwhelmed, spellbound by the mystery of the outside world, especially the world of women, love, and sex, as revealed to us by these Western writers day after day, page after page, book after book. Not only had Four Eyes left the mountain without daring to denounce us, also, as luck would have it, our headman had gone away to the town of Yongjing to attend a Communist Party conference. In the ensuing political vacuum, our village lapsed into quiet anarchy, and Luo and I stopped going to work in the fields without the villagers, themselves unwilling converts from opium farmers to guardians of our souls, raising the slightest objection. I kept my door more securely locked than ever and passed the time with foreign novels. Since Balzac was Luo's favorite, I put him to one side, and with the ardor and earnestness of my 18 years, I fell in love with one author after another. Flaubert, Gogol, Melville, and even Romain Rolland. Let me tell you about Romain Rolland. Among the books in Four Eyes' suitcase, there was only one by him, volume one of his four-volume masterpiece, Jean Christophe. The Chinese translation was by Foulet, who also did the Balzac translations. As the story was about a musician and I myself played pieces on the violin, such as Mozart is thinking of Chairman Mao, I was naturally drawn to the book. I had intended only a brief flirtation, a skim read, but once I had opened the book, I couldn't put it down. Until then, short stories had been my favorite reading, well-wrought and sparkling with ideas, tales that made you laugh or took your breath away, that would stay with you for the rest of your days. I was more dubious about full-length novels. But Jean Christophe, with his fierce individualism utterly untainted by malice, was a salutary revelation. Without him, I would never have understood the splendor of taking free and independent action as an individual. Up until this stolen encounter with Romain Rolland's hero, my poor educated and re-educated brains had been incapable of grasping the notion of one man standing up against the whole world. The flirtation turned into a grand passion. Even the excessively emphatic style occasionally indulged in by the author did not detract from the beauty of this astonishing work of art. I was carried away, swept along by the mighty stream of words pouring from the hundreds of pages. To me, it was the ultimate book. Once you had read it, neither your own life nor the world you lived in would ever look the same. My passion for Jean Christophe was so great that, for the first time in my life, I wanted something to be my very own, rather than a possession I shared with Luo. So, I wrote an inscription on the flyleaf to the effect that the book was a gift for my next birthday, and asked Luo to sign it. He said he was flattered, as the occasion was so momentous that it deserved to go down in history. He calligraphed his name with a single brushstroke, unbridled, lavish, spirited, linking together the three characters with an elegant flourish that took up almost half the page. For my part, I dedicated three books by Balzac to him as a gift for the coming new year, Père Goriot, Eugénie Grandet, and Ursule Mirouet. Beneath my dedication, I drew three figures representing the three Chinese characters constituting my name. The first was a galloping horse with a long mane flying in the wind. The second, a long pointed sword with a finely carved bone handle set with diamonds. And the third was a bell, around which I drew a number of short strokes like rays to suggest that it was sounding the alarm. I was so pleased with my dedication that I was tempted to add a drop or two of my blood by way of consecration. Towards the middle of the month, a violent storm raged on the mountain. It lasted all night long. The rain was torrential. The next morning, Luo, true to his ambition to endow the lovely little seamstress with culture, set off at first light with Père Goriot in his bamboo hod. Like a knight errant, though lacking a steed, he vanished into the morning mist shrouding the path to the little seamstress's village. Not wishing to break the curfew imposed by the political authority, he retraced his steps in the evening and returned meekly to our house on stilts. He said the rain had created havoc on the mountain, and that he had been obliged to climb a vertiginous, narrow ridge thrown up by an enormous landslide. "The little seamstress and you would have run right over it," he said dolefully,
but I had to get down on my hands and knees and crawl. I was that scared.
Was it a long way?
At least 40 meters.
It was a mystery to me why Luo, who seemed so daring in all things, should have such a dread of heights. He was an intellectual type and had never climbed a tree in his life. I still remember the afternoon in our boyhood when we were seized with the idea of climbing the rusty iron ladder of a water tower. Right from the start, he scraped the palms of his hands on the rust, and when we were 15 meters up, he said, "I keep having the feeling the rungs will collapse under my weight." His hands were bleeding and painful, which only increased his fear. In the end, he gave up, leaving me to climb the rest of the way on my own. From the top of the tower, I leaned over to spit down on him for a joke, but my spittle was swept away by the wind. 5 or 6 years had passed since then, but his dread of heights had not diminished. And he was quite right about the little seamstress and me having no trouble at all running over the narrowest mountain ridge. In fact, once we had reached the other side, we would often have to wait for Luo to catch up with us, which could take a long time because he had to get down and crawl. One day, for a change of air, I decided to accompany Luo on his pilgrimage to the little seamstress's village. By the time we reached the perilous path Luo had told me about, the soft morning breeze had made way for a mountain gale. I gasped when I saw the risk Luo had been taking every day. Even I started trembling when I set foot on the ridge. My left boot dislodged a stone, and almost at the same moment my right boot pushed some clods of earth over the side. They tumbled into the depths, and it was some time before we heard them hitting the bottom at different intervals. The sound reverberated into the distance, first on the right, then on the left. I should never have looked down. To my right gaped a rocky crevasse of dizzying depth, at the bottom of which the trees were swathed in mist. My ears started buzzing when I looked to my left, where the earth had fallen away to create a sheer drop 50 meters deep. Fortunately, it was not quite as far over the ridge as Luo had said. On a boulder at the other end perched a raven with a red beak, its head ominously drawn into its shoulders. "Do you want me to take your hod?" I offered casually. Luo was hanging back at the beginning of the path. "Yes, please, you take it." When I hoisted it onto my back, I was buffeted by a blast of wind. The buzzing noise in my ears grew louder, and as I tossed my head to get rid of it, I felt the stirrings of vertigo. At that point it was bearable, even slightly pleasant. I took a few steps. When I glanced over my shoulder, I saw Luo still in the same place, his silhouette swaying gently like a tree in the wind. Keeping my eyes resolutely fixed to the ground, I advanced with slow, faltering steps like a tightrope walker. But when I was midway, I saw the rocks ahead of me lurching to the right, then to the left, as if in an earthquake. Instinctively, I bent down, and the vertigo did not subside until I was crouched low enough to steady myself with both hands. Rivulets of sweat trickled down my back, chest, and forehead. I wiped my brow with the back of my hand and was surprised at how cold the sweat was. I looked over my shoulder again at Luo. He seemed to be calling out to me, but his voice was swallowed up by the buzzing in my head. Raising my eyes to avoid looking at the drop,